You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join C-Link's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 160 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. Today, I am sharing an ebook which I wrote about the opportunities available to contractors on a D&B contract. I'm a sad man, as you all know, so that's why I wrote it. And actually, it was an ebook I wrote off the back of a seminar that I did for a contractor in-house. Many people don't understand at contractors that on a D&B contract, you have exactly the same level of responsibility, obligations, and just general level of the architect. I wrote this ebook as part of a seminar I held, and really it's all about the leverage you have as a contractor and making the most of it on a D&B contract. It's in the show notes, so feel free to go and see it. On to today's show, and it's a special show. We're at number 160, the milestones keep on coming. I am joined in the studio by Ellie Carswell, who is an award-winning construction project manager. She is the founder and chair of G4C Kent Club, the Constructing Excellence Kent Vice Chair. She does so much, I'm even struggling to get it out. Ellie, welcome to Own the Build. How are you?
Thanks, Paul. I'm brilliant, thank you. Doing very well. Coming to the end of January, getting some more sunny days in the diary, which is good.
Exactly. That's what we need. The days are getting longer. This is what we need in our lives, isn't it? So I've tried to give a bit of an overview of you and what you're doing. But if you could just share your journey today, your construction experience and what you're doing today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I joined the industry nearly 6 years ago now. As a non-cognate. So I studied French and Italian at university, did not know that I was going to end up in a career in construction. And after I graduated, I fell into a graduate scheme with my employer, then Faithful and Gould, now Atkins Realis. And from there, I've really just loved every moment and developed in what's been a very interesting and different career. Every day is different. So in my role as a project manager now, I predominantly deliver public sector projects for local authorities, which I absolutely love. I love delivering projects that give back to community, but I also do a lot outside of work to do with next gen in construction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is how we connected initially. There's obviously the blog which goes out with this, which Ellie has kindly written for us. And before we get into construction, I think I might have mentioned this to you before, but I am busily learning Italian myself right now. So we could do the rest of this show in an incredibly broken Italian, but I think for both, definitely for my ego, it's probably better that we don't do that. But so how did you end up wanting to do languages and study languages? How on earth did you end up with us in construction?
It's quite a jump, isn't it? So when I left school, I definitely wasn't ready for the world of work. So I decided to go to university and study something that I enjoy. The bonus being if I did Italian, then I could live in Italy and soak up all of the sun, cheese, and everything like that, ice cream. But while I was at uni, I realised that I didn't want to work in languages because it's quite solitary. And I'm definitely a team player. I love working as part of a team. And whilst at university, my employer was delivering a new building on our campus. And that's how I met them, through a careers fair. And it got me thinking, yeah, very random, but it got me thinking about my soft skills, which is something that I plug a lot in the industry. So you don't need to come from a technical background to do well in construction. And I started to focus on those softer skills and came to project management as a career route and landed in construction.
And so what was your perception when you were in this, I'm guessing it was either a new wing of the university was being built or was just built. What was your perception of construction, both entering that careers fair and then coming out of that careers fair?
Entering, I think my initial perception was definitely it was an industry that was quite cold, quite cutthroat perhaps, and definitely male dominated. I think that's an obvious one. But I've been pleasantly surprised. And I think year on year that I'm in my role, it keeps getting better in terms of the balance between not just gender balance, but in terms of backgrounds all across the world, diversity in thought as well is a lot more prevalent in our industry now since when I joined back in 2018. So my initial thought was perhaps quite negative. And I think coming out of it, I like a challenge and I've always loved the challenge. And I thought,
I'm going to turn this industry around. Just you wait.
Not me on my own, but maybe with others with me. But absolutely, I will admit, I loved the whole women in construction movement. It got me excited. I also love the fact that construction is tangible. The outputs that you're getting, they're tangible. And for me, having a career that is rewarding is by far the most important aspect for me.
Yeah, I mean, dedicated listeners have heard it many, many times, but absolutely for me personally, the takeaway of being able to walk through central London, central Birmingham, central Manchester, I've done projects across the country where you think, yes, I remember the tears that went into putting that project together. And it's something so tangible, isn't it? As that takeaway. Just it segues us nicely onto, could you just talk then about the kind of projects you said you're working on, public sector projects? Before we came into the studio, you were kind of saying that there's three projects that you're working on at the moment. Just describe what you do.
So at the moment, I am working on three local authority projects. Two are with Surrey County Council as part of their adult social care scheme. So residential projects, essentially, that have a care element to them, giving back to community. And the third is a regeneration project. And it's actually in my hometown of Dover, which is fantastic. It's right on my doorstep. And I am that typical family member now that drives past site and points and says, that's my project.
Check it out.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, but that's cool.
That is a great project for Dover. So Dover is a town that is really known as being a gateway to Europe, essentially. And it's receiving a lot of investment from the Levelling Up Fund, which is fantastic. So I'm excited to see what this project delivers and what it brings to Dover as a town.
And so regeneration in Dover, just roughly talk through like what the scope of the work is and what specifically you're doing on that job.
So I am effectively working as the client representative on the project, or the employer's agent, if you like. Project managing everything between the contractor and the client TA team. It's delivering a building with three individual spaces. So one is a creative centre, another is a creative campus, and the third is a business centre. And the idea is that students will go to the campus and learn digital and creative arts courses, and then they'll progress through the building. So the building itself is a regeneration project for the regeneration of the town, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, sounds great. And particularly in your hometown, I can imagine you being that annoying family member saying, check out what I'm doing. I'm about to change the place we live. But like I was saying, that is the beauty of construction and actually having that tangible impact. So as your role is employer's agent, is what kind of what you're saying. So talk to me briefly then about your 6 years into your career. Talk to me about project management and your relationship on the project with both, I guess, your QS, which I guess is your PQS, and also with the contractor. I guess starting first with the PQS, bearing in mind, Ellie, that we are talking right now to lots and lots of quantity surveyors, commercial managers, commercial directors, so you've got to be nice to us. But it's really interesting to get a different perspective. We talk QSing all day, every day on this show, so it's interesting to get your perspective on that.
So I am going to be positive, actually.
She's smirking, though, guys. She's smirking.
So what I love, and I'm actually quite a big advocate of within our industry, is we're a team for a reason, and that's because everybody has their own skill set. So I'm a project manager, and I will openly admit that I'm useless with numbers. I studied maths at A-level, but I would not be able to recall any of it. So having somebody who can work with me to develop a proposal, for example, is the whole benefit of team working, in my opinion.
How do you collaborate with the QS within your team? I mean, like, what are you looking for in that relationship?
So for me, I see the project manager role as the key communicator. So the person that is linking everybody up together, making everybody aware of what's required of them in terms of their deliverables, and ultimately making sure that everybody's sticking to their deadlines. So I love the fact that my role enables me to speak to lots of people, make sure they're okay. So I keep it quite personal. I like to check in on people to make sure that they're okay outside of work. But in terms of projects and bringing it back down to the timeline, just having weekly meetings with the whole team, really, and going through project progress, flagging issues as soon as they arise. I think having quite that collaborative, honest, open approach is a much better way to handle things rather than having an issue. Everybody argues about it and we don't get anywhere. Whereas if we adopt open conversations from the outset, I think it works quite well for project delivery.
And so just talking about, you know, you talked about like the way you see the future of the industry. You've been in it for 6 years now. You talk about, you almost exemplified there what feels like a story or a memory from projects that you were on, maybe at the early stages of your career, where you saw not disputes, but, you know, like friction almost.
Contractual friction. Yeah.
How do you try and approach project management in the context of working with contractors as EA?
So I think project management is essentially people management, and creating those relationships with key stakeholders, which includes the project team, obviously, is absolutely fundamental. I think it heavily depends on the contract that you use. And I do prefer using a partnering style type of contract that promotes earlier conversations, shall we say, around issues that may come up, and encourages you to adopt that collaborative approach from the outset.
You are talking my language here. We were talking internally about early contractor involvement, how we build that into our product and like our thesis, because it totally echoes with my experience. I was always a subcontractor, so, you know, being involved early allows a completely different project output from us and like project impact from us, I would say, by being involved early. So when you talk about you prefer partnering as a contract form or a procurement route, what kind of contracts are you on then? Like which contracts are you using?
In the past, I've used NEC3. At the moment, I'm using JCT. So I think ultimately, if you look at the collaborative contracts in the market, you immediately think of NEC, I think. In my previous experience, I delivered a lot of MOJ projects and they actually adopted a contract called PPC 2000, which I don't really think is heavily used at the moment. But again, it's a partnering contract where it encourages the naming of the team members in the aid of collaboration. So it's not to, I don't know, play the blame game or anything like that. It's to actively or proactively say from the outset, this is our project team. If there are any issues, this is who needs to be in a meeting to discuss it. So it's promoting that open communication again. More so than the contract that you choose, I think definitely it does come back to tendering and procurement. So you mentioned early contractor involvement. Actually having an approach which encourages more contractors to engage with the client and the client team earlier, in my eyes, only improves the project experience going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's exactly what we were talking about just the other day in our office. So how are you doing that then in terms of like the project that you're currently working on? How are you promoting that early contractor involvement?
So on the Dover project that I'm delivering, we adopted a two-stage design and build approach, taking two stages right back to stage two. So having that early contractor involvement earlier, as early as possible, really. And also being very selective about the framework that we go out to with the pool of contractors that are able to tender for the project, making sure that they have the right expertise and also the right local knowledge. That was really fundamental for this project. And I think it's really important for clients to consider when they're selecting a contractor that it's not just about cost and program and kind of quality. There are so many other aspects that come into it. And if you are able to appoint a contractor that has local knowledge, and in Dover's case, this has worked wonders, they immediately open up a more trusted supply chain, which inevitably has a better impact on cost and program in the long term.
From your perspective, so you just said when time and cost obviously play a big part in the procurement process, but they are absolutely not everything. What do you look for in your contractor interviews or contract, like through, I always view the tender process as a prism in which to view the project process. So you're speaking to three different candidates, let's say, and how they manage the tender process, whether they're communicative, whether they do things on time, like just the general approach. I always thought you can line them up as to then how the project is going to go. That's not always the case, right? Sometimes you get a tender team followed by a completely different project team, but that's how I viewed it. How do you assess, particularly around the soft skills, which you seem to be so interested in, contractors, and how do they line up?
So firstly, within the ITT itself, I will state that I would like the delivery team to be at the interview so I can get a feel for them. So that's an expectation from the outset. And I think it comes down to communication, but also honesty. So I'll give an example of this on the Dover project that we've just tendered and the contractor's now appointed. We went out with an ambitious programme. And what we asked was for a realistic response.
A client went out with an ambitious programme.
Yeah, you wouldn't think it. So we asked for a realistic response. One contractor came back and met the programme expectations of our ambitious programme. The other contractor, who actually was successful, didn't.
Okay.
And they were very honest.
They gave you the bad
news. And they set out, but they set out exactly why they didn't think that programme was achievable. So we were then able to dig into a bit more detail during the tender interviews about each of the respective programmes. And it revealed to me that the team in front of me, the successful contractor, were very knowledgeable of the project. So they'd obviously done their research. They'd thought about potential issues that could come up with the site in question. So they'd visited the site. They'd obviously had some prior knowledge or engagement with those in and around the site. And they were able to formulate a very honest response. And to me, honesty is everything. And it came across as very genuine. So it came across as they would absolutely love to deliver this project, but they will deliver it for this program. And if ultimately program is the most important thing, then they wouldn't be able to deliver it. And I thought that's really refreshing.
Yeah, yeah. It's exactly what you want to hear. You're managing risk, aren't you? And it's much better to know what your actual risks are and to understand them. So just so I'm clear, roughly speaking, how long is the overall program for this project? Is it a year? Is it 2 years, 3 years? Roughly.
It's about 2.5 years.
2.5 years. And your ambitious program was roughly, was 2.5 years or was it 2 years? Or like
2 years, so slightly over.
That was classically ambitious. And so this successful contractor, I think this is a really important and interesting point. This successful contractor came back and said it's going to be more like 2.5 years. And which is, when you think about it, that's a pretty savage thing to say in some respects, isn't it? Like, that's saying, no, this is unrealistic. We're the experts. This is why we think X, Y, and Z. So it's going to be an extra, effectively 25% almost of program time. What is it? Because I think there's such a lesson to be learned there. During the tender phase, quite often, whether you're a main contractor, whether you're a subcontractor, you're much more interested, or I know that some people are interested in winning the job, get on the job, and then have a dust up. That's not the intent, but often you think, well, maybe in the best case, it could be 2 years, and the worst case is three, right? So what is there for our listeners to take away from? What did they really tell you that made you think, I trust them much more? And now you effectively trust it's 2.5 years, not two.
For me, it was the two-stage approach that we'd adopted, and they'd recognised that. And I think a lot of us will have experienced a significant increase in the second stage, whether it be in programme or whether it be in cost. So having cost certainty was equally as important for our client as well as the programme. And they just showed willing to work towards the original target. So this is our current expectation of what this project is going to take to deliver. We know that you have these targets. They recognise that we have these ambitions, and we will work with you to get back to that. So it very much was that collaborative approach from the outset that got me.
Absolutely. And it's realism as well, rather than fantasy, yeah. which you know, matters. So interesting. We've gone way, way, way off piece here, which is great. I mean, that shows we're having a good conversation. So let's take a little break and we'll come back and we'll talk about some other bits and pieces. Right now, there are between 5 and 10,000 QS vacancies in the UK. Loads of main contractors that we speak to are struggling to recruit and find QSs, and also struggling to recruit and find high quality subcontractors given the skills shortage. Having worked as a QS for many years, I've seen firsthand the challenges of managing subcontract procurement, and I understand that many projects will fail by getting procurement wrong. This is why we built C-Link. With C-Link, you will build resilience. You'll centralize your supply chain data, automate procurement, and access digital contracts to present yourself as a world-class contractor. To find out more, you can now go to the show notes and you will see that we have included a video and a demo link so that you can meet either me or meet the team and understand better what we do. I look forward to speaking to you all. Thank you very much. So, Ellie, I really enjoyed that, the first half of the show, where we talked, you know, we're a bit more project specific. We were talking about what you as a project manager look for, which is really, really great. What I want to do in the second half is zoom out and go a little bit more industry wide, if you like, rather than project specific, because that's how we initially sparked our conversation. Before I do, perhaps a bit of a silly question, but one thing that did stand out to me from talking to you is that jump from learning languages to being a project manager. Maybe a stupid question, but is there anything from learning languages that supports you in being an effective project manager?
Absolutely. So learning languages, I'm speaking with people from all over the world. I actually got to live in two different countries. So I lived in France and Italy for a little while, which was fantastic as part of my degree. So I just really gained that appreciation of different cultures. I guess the struggle that you can have with communication and why communication is so important in anything in life, really. So yeah, it definitely gave me a good grounding for my career in construction.
And so it allows you to communicate with people with whom it's difficult to communicate with, aka people in construction at times.
Exactly.
Excellent. So let's focus in now on your article, kind of what you wrote for us and why. And I'm just going to extract an element of our conversation, which is a study that you refer to, which is, according to a Deloitte study, whilst financial security is deemed necessary, of course, for Generation Z, Gen Z, value salary as less important than any other generation before them. And instead, they favour companies that demonstrate a commitment to society, community, and people. You're nodding your head. How does that make you feel?
I think it's brilliant. And I actually think it's quite reflective of what our industry is trying to achieve. I think if you take away the daily tasks that we have, which can be hard at times, I know construction can be difficult to work in. But if you look at actually what our industry is looking to achieve, we're looking to achieve a better future for everybody, a better environment, to create better communities. So without construction and without buildings, without property, we wouldn't be able to have these communities that we are creating. So it boggles my mind every day why our industry isn't more attractive to the next generation, because that is what we're looking to achieve. But I think it just doesn't translate to that, whether that's through the news or whether that's in education. It doesn't come across that that's what we're trying to achieve.
I think it's a really nice angle that I've never looked at it that way, but absolutely, we're trying to create new neighbourhoods, new public realms, new communities, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah. You're absolutely right. It's funny though, because my perspective, having been in the industry for almost 20 years now, was that, and it probably is a bit of a tired perception of it, but it is that the industry is pretty aggressive place to be at the best of times. It's long hours, it's tough hours. But the thing that always kind of stood out to me as like a USP, if you like, for the sector, was kind of two points. And it was all about money. I know that might sound a bit stupid, but I used to think, A, we generally get pretty well paid for what we do in construction. Like, for instance, average QS salary isn't too far off the average GP salary. And if you compare the two roles, they're completely different, right? You have to get a completely different set of qualifications. So it kind of tells you where we are. But also, I always thought that it's such an entrepreneurial opportunity in construction. Anyone can set up a company, whether you're a tradesperson, whether you're a consultant, and just set up and build a business on your own. And that I find to be really, really unique. And there's so many people who've got amazing stories of that. But when I read what you'd written and thought, well, if Gen Z don't value money so much, that for me that isn't what the reason why I'm in the industry, but that for me always sort felt like a selling point, is you can make good money and blah blah blah. But how do you feel about that?
I think it's a valid point, and yes, we do generally get well paid in our industry, but that doesn't come without long hours, as you say, a stressful environment at times. So I think it's actually, the point of that study was saying that Gen Z don't care how much you pay them if the job is still going to be stressful and is not going to reward them outside of that financial gain. So we need to start thinking of other ways that we can attract them in, whether that is through social value initiatives, for example, where they can make a mark on local communities, or whether that's through celebrating their opinions, challenging the status quo, how we've done things in the industry for years. That probably is more valuable to them because they're making a lasting impact, rather than we'll chuck a load of money at them, they'll work however many hours we want, that's just not going to cut it anymore.
It's interesting, that social value piece, because I hadn't considered it in the perspective that you're explaining it, because there is a really nice community project about a 10-minute walk from my house, and it's on the beachfront, and I will often go and walk there and check out progress because I'm a construction geek, loser, whatever you want to call me. But like, and there's so much value that it's actually going to bring to the community, and it's a lovely, lovely project. And they sell it quite nicely on the hoarding, and that's kind of, when you actually zoom out and think about it, that is something that all sites try and do. This is what we're doing for the community, blah, blah, blah. And so often we are doing amazing things for the community. However, those messages, well, at least in my experience, don't seep through into the wider consciousness of society, if that makes sense. It's, there's a building site there, and yeah, there's some stuff on the hoarding. Happy days. But it's this building site, and more have them now. I've got like that little Perspex window every few hoards, and you know, you see people, parents lifting up their kids and them looking through and seeing what's going on. And it does fill you with some hope. But I'm a bit of a negative Nelly, if that's the right way of putting it, about the industry and like how we can actually promote ourselves. Because I think it's an absolutely amazing place to work, but I don't think I do that good a job of upselling it to everyone else, mainly because of the perceptions that everyone else has of us. I know that might sound a bit bizarre.
No, it makes sense. And I think it ultimately comes down to this race to the bottom challenge that we have on many of our projects, not just in relation to cost, but driving time as well and driving efficiency out of staff. So I'm working on 3 projects, and I'm sure there are many other project managers that have got many more than 3 projects that they have to deal with in a week. So it's actually thinking, if we were to, I guess it needs to come from top down, doesn't it? It needs to come with a change in client mindset about money and how much things cost. But if you're wanting to deliver a project, but also deliver something valuable back to the community as part of that project, it needs to cost more and it's going to take more time. And I think there needs to be an acceptance of that, or at least an awareness with clients who are open to taking that approach to better their local community. But in reality, it never works like that, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's funny. A lot of what you're saying echoes through the more contemporary episodes of the show that we've done, where we're talking a lot about, we as a construction sector, and I mean subcontractor, contractor, and like consultant team, should collectively, if we were to collectively push back on clients and say we're not doing this anymore, the world would change, wouldn't it? But we can't do that. And I'd love to actually speak to a couple of clients about that exact point that you're just making, because I'm sure there are clients thinking, you know, we put social value at the heart of what we do, et cetera, et cetera. But it still comes back to time, cost, and quality. So often, cost remains at the heart of the conversation when it comes down to procurement, right? So it's
exactly. And I think it's the human factor in our industry. And that's something which, at first, I had that negative view of. I didn't think there was a human factor. I thought it was a massive machine with lots of little cogs that kept on turning. But actually, all those cogs are people, and we need to remember that. And it's really important. Obviously, there are quite stark statistics out there around mental health, and I don't want to go into them because it's very upsetting. But our industry's not doing great in that regard. So
there are a lot.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is difficult. There's more and more organisations doing amazing things. You know, definitely, I came in 2007 to the industry, and where we are now versus where we were then, it's apples and not even pears. I can't even, it's apples and cheddar. It's completely different, right? We're in a completely different space. Yeah, it's not easy. Talk to me though, because you told me an interesting story. I'd love the audience to hear it, about you going back to your school and selling your profession. And it's funny, right? Because you seem to love what you do. You seem to be doing really, really well. You seem to be a bit of a pioneer, really, for what you're bringing. You're passionate about it. You're writing about it. You're doing so much. And so you go back to your school. Tell me about that experience.
Yeah. So for those listening, I went to an all-girls grammar school, which was very, very traditional. It was university or nothing at the time when I was there. So considering a career in construction was unknown, or a surprise, shall we say, in a polite way. And one year I was invited back to attend a careers fair that they had, and had quite good connections with the school. I was a prefect at the time. So absolutely, I wanted to go back and share my experience of being in construction, and a woman in construction especially. And it wasn't until I was actually at the career fair that I realised the issue wasn't with the students. The students were so excited to hear what I did and were excited about all the different roles that we have within the industry. It was the parents. So I probably had a handful of parents that actually looked at the stand, immediately saw what to do with construction, and almost steered their girls away from the stand. Don't go that way. So I think it's the perception that parents have of our industry. And it probably goes back to my initial perception that it's dirty. You're going to wear site boots and hard hats, and it's going to be muddy all the time. But
it is, right? That is a fact. It is going to be like that. Whatever spin we put on it, that is the reality, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that is an element of the reality, I would say. It's not the full picture. So yes, that it depends what role you do in construction. Some are more site-based than others. There are obviously roles that are completely non-site-based. So if you don't want to go onto site, then you still can work in the industry.
Lots of QSs.
Yeah, once a month for your evaluation.
If you're lucky, Ellie, if you're lucky. Yeah, but so I think you're right. I think, like I said, my outlook on it at times can be quite pessimistic, is probably the word. But it is really, and if you tie what Gen Z value, which, as you say, it's commitment to society, communities, and people. And if you tie that to the story that you painted at the start of this conversation, where you said, and the listeners can't see your smile, but you were beaming from ear to ear saying, I love working on this project in my local community. It's doing X, Y, and Z. And I'm proud of it. I'm proud of having that impact. And if you talk about that project that, in my mind, down the road is having exactly the same impact, it's going to have such an impact on our community. We don't tell that story, and we should. Do you see organizations who are telling that story well? Like, is that what drew you in initially at that careers fair?
I think initially what drew me in was the project management and the soft skills and the thought of working as part of a team. To be honest, I had an interest in construction just through family members that work in construction. And I think we can all say that we've got at least one family member that works in construction. And it was the challenge to overcome a hurdle that the industry faced, that it was very male dominated and it needed a shake up. So whenever I go and tell my story, I tell exactly that. I try and encourage others. Do you not want to be part of this movement where you can make a better world? You can create better environments for people. But I think that message almost needs to go right down to parents, not just to the schools and the education providers and the teachers. It needs to get back to their homes, to who's bringing them up, who's influencing them when they're not at school, because that's the biggest decider on their career, I think.
100%. And we need more people like you in the industry telling your story and explaining it the way that you do. My final question for you. We've talked about the skills crisis on this show. I think there's an additional 225,000 workers required by 2027, according to the Construction Skills Network. This is a big question, Ellie, but with everything that you do, you're involved in lots of different networks and groups, and you write a lot about this topic. You go to careers fairs. What would your advice be to anybody listening as to how we can better promote construction generally, so that it seeps into the minds of, you know, the parent, et cetera, everyone in the community?
I think we need to lose construction and encourage built environment. So I think built environment in itself sounds a little bit more positive, and it almost brings in the community aspect, doesn't it? In built environment, it's an environment. It's a place that people want to live, want to work, want to share experiences. So I would lose the construction and look at it from a built environment perspective. But I think for me, just don't limit yourself to certain pools of people. I think that's so important, because if my company, for example, did that, I wouldn't have been employed by them. I wouldn't have gone on to be a project manager. I wouldn't have gone on to win an award. So it's little things like that, that just don't limit yourself like you would limit others, really.
Yeah. No, it's a great way to end the show. And honestly, that is I've never thought about the difference, because you hear built environment, don't you, all the time, but you never hear the industry described as the built environment. And it's actually a much wider description as well. It takes in so much more as opposed to construction, which is site. Plant, isn't it? It's much more.
Yeah, it is. It's very here's construction.
yeah, indeed. Well, I will be sharing Ellie's details and her blog and article in the show notes. I will be back next week. Ellie, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I really appreciate having had you on the show.
Thank you. It's been fantastic. Thanks, Paul.
Amazing. Guys, I will speak to you next week. Have a great weekend. Cheers.